I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with another Saturday live stream, and we have some guests from the UK on tonight. In the first hour, we have our friend Mark Collett of Patriotic Alternative. Mark, welcome.
Hello, my friend. It's good to be back on Countercurrents. I hope you're well, not spoken to you for a while. And I was actually thinking of you the other day because you have threatened to publish some new books for us to cover on the book review.
And oh, yeah.
I hope we'll do that soon because some of the book reviews we've done over the years have been some of the best we've ever done. So it'd be great to get you back on
and
review whatever Countercurrents has been up to.
Great. And those review shows always produce a lot of interest in the books. The show has some clout. You've got a lot of literate readers in the UK, and it makes a big difference. So yeah, we'll definitely
do that. Well, the best one was the Yockey one. That got some right feedback. So if we if you ever publish anything by him again, we'd definitely like to do a follow-up to that show.
I just sent Imperium to the printers this week, so we'll have that out basically within a month or so for the paperback and the hardcover soon after. So once we have paperbacks of Imperium, we'll send it all to you because we'll send it to all of you. And you'll have to spend a couple months going through it because it's a whopping 688 pages. But I'd love it if you do a review of that. And we have some other stuff that's a bit shorter in the works as well. So thanks.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate that. Yeah. So our other guest is our friend Morgoth, Morgoth of Morgoth's Review. Welcome.
Hello again. How are we doing, everybody? Yeah, it's nice to be back on, Greg. There's a lot to discuss. There's a lot going on in Britain at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a busy news time in America with the recent debates and everything, but I want to turn our attention, like the great eye of Sauron across the Atlantic, to the UK, where next Thursday, I believe it is, there is going to be a general election. And it's extraordinary that the election was ever called. I still don't quite understand the rationale of that. Also, Macron in a snit has called an election soon. And there is a real possibility that the Conservative Party, which is, I think, one of the oldest political parties in the world, that's still active, might just be destroyed. It could go from the number one party to the number, I'd like to see them number three or number four. And the meme, of course, has been zero seats. Picture a world with zero Tory seats. It would be well-deserved. I salivate at that prospect because I think that white identity politics is only going to flourish if we have massive shakeups of the existing political establishment, what Eatwell and Goodwin call de-alignment. And we've seen that in a lot of countries. We've seen, for instance, in the recent French general election, it was a contest between, it's as if the American election were being run and the leading two candidates were not Democrats or Republicans. We had Marine Le Pen and we had Macron with his fake centrist party that had been whipped up just a few years ago. That's an extraordinary de-alignment from the old center-left and old center-right parties they had. I would love to see one of the pillars of center-right conservative politics, namely the UK Conservative Party, destroyed. Why? Well, because these people have betrayed the people they represent. And I would like this to happen because I want this to serve as an example to the other center-right cuck parties around. I want this to strike fear into their hearts that if they keep betraying their voters and their nations as flagrantly as they do, they might have no political careers. Their political careers could be canceled. And so I love the zero seats meme, and Morgoth has been a big promoter of that. And I wanted to have a couple of UK political watchers and activists on to talk about the prospects for zero seats. So I guess the first question is, why was this general election called? It still seems murky to me why this was done. And Mark, do you want to go first on this? Why did Sunak do this?
Well, there's been a couple of theories. The first theory is that Sunak just wants out, that he's done, he's finished, he can't be bothered with it anymore. And I suppose that is a reasonable theory because he is getting absolutely hammered and he's probably realised that, you know, his wife's a billionaire. He can do pretty much what he wants with his life. Wherever he goes, he's going to have a great income, a great lifestyle. Does he need the stress? That's one theory. The other theory that seems to be quite prevalent is that Britain is getting more and more desperate over the situation in the Ukraine. There has been a massive ramping up of this rhetoric that Britain needs to be actively involved in that war. There has been an increased talk of conscription. There has been an increased talk of, well, Sunak has come out with this national service thing. And essentially, a lot of pundits are saying that if a government was to take us into war, whether that be in the Ukraine or the Middle East, that government would need a clean bill of health. And the Conservative Party at the moment is so completely damaged, so completely tarnished in every way possible, on migration, on taxation, on treatment of the elderly, the collapsing NHS, anything that you can think of, they're tarnished on right now. And if they were to take us to a war footing, they just simply wouldn't have the credibility. And interestingly, Sunak has sort of added fuel to this fire by making the very odd statement that he does not want to be a wartime prime minister. So around the time he called this election, he actually said, I don't want to be a wartime prime minister. And the election was called. Now, obviously, some of this is conjecture, but a lot of people are discussing this particular issue. And if Labour does get in, which it looks very likely they will, it appears that they will come in with something like between 500 and 550 seats, one of the greatest parliamentary majorities we've ever seen, post-Second World War, possibly ever, in fact. And that would give them quite a mandate to do what they want. And if you look at the last time Britain did enter one of these sort of disastrous foreign wars, who was the party that took us there? It was Labour. So there's a lot of conjecture about this. I think I've discussed this with Morgoth on a stream, and I've seen plenty of content creators discussing this. And if this isn't the case, I'm a little bit of a loss to why it would be, because this, I mean, a lot of, I'll wrap this up quickly because I want Morgoth to have his say, obviously, but a lot of Americans don't understand this, that it's actually the Prime Minister's prerogative in Britain to call the general election. And Sunak has up to 5 years in power. A government has up to 5 years in power. So he could have called the election as late as January 2025. And generally speaking, if things are going badly for a party, that party holds off calling an election until there's a upswing in their fortunes. So for him to go early at a time when they are more hated than ever before, there doesn't seem to be any normal rationale behind this.
Morgoth, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, my initial take on it was Mark's second point there, that the decks are being cleared and something big is coming. I didn't want to sort of speculate on what that would be. Obviously, there's a lot of talk around Russia. There's a lot of talk also about issues in the Middle East, wider trade wars with China. Or it could be an economic collapse is coming. Just in terms of Sunak's kind of weird calling of the election, though, I was thinking, well, I don't know which of those sort of scenarios it is, but my impression here is that they've called the election because something is coming. I don't know exactly what, but something is coming. And they're battening down the hatches. They want Labour in with a huge majority. They want fresh faces in to deal with what the big thing that's going to come. And another sort of aspect to this, which was completely farcical, was that so you actually had the election when he called the election, which he didn't really need to, but it was the way that he called it as well. He was standing in it, like it was pouring down with rain, and his suit was just completely saturated, drenched through. And then over the top of that, somebody played the Tony Blair anthem, Things Can Only Get Better. And over the next few days, it was just this farce. And I was coming to the conclusion, like, they want to lose. They're throwing this. Because I think he announced, he called the election, he got soaking wet. That was a farce. That was a complete joke. And then I think he took the day off, the next day off. And then the day after that, he said that they were going to probably bring back national service, which, you know, when you consider that most of the Tory voters are boomers with kids and whatnot, it becomes, and how is that going to be reaching out to the kids? Mm-hmm. And then there was like a whole series of things. Some of them are passing me mind now. I mean, he even went to Belfast, where you've got the Museum of the Titanic, the day after that, and conducted a little interview. So you had the Titanic Museum in Belfast. It's sort of like the hull, the bow of the Titanic. So it's like this huge point, but it's also kind of in the shape of an iceberg. And so at any rate, this was the symbolism. This was the symbolism.
It's like Monty Python was scripting this or something to make it maximally humiliating and bizarre.
And this was the so this was the backdrop. This was the symbolism that all of this was playing out to. And then a few days after that, you had the big D-Day celebrations on. Biden managed to shuffle on over. You had Macron, you had Scholz of Germany, and Rishi Sunak chucked it halfway through. Didn't show up. They had to have David Cameron pop up, who's a foreign secretary, in his place, and he came back to do an ITV interview. And there was just this sort of gaffe after gaffe after gaffe. And my view was that, this seems to be that they're chucking it. And that there was more than that. Everything was bad. Everything was cringe. He did like a TikTok video, which was... if you cut it, the TikTok video, he was talking about how, this is the Rishi Sunak talking to the youth. This is the TikTok youth vote. And he was telling them how he was going to bring back national service and how cool it was.
Oh, that'll be popular with the TikTok generation. Yeah.
And one of the things that caught me was that, you know how they try to edit it like a Zoomer would do a TikTok video. So it was all really quick jump cuts and it was chaotic. And they did one thing where they had his kind of boring Indian face, and it sort of multiplied all over the screen so that like the screen just filled up with faces of Rishi Sunak. Like it was about 50 faces. And you just thought, what the hell are they playing?
Nobody wants to see that much of Rishi Sunak.
Well, I put it on Twitter. I say, this just looks like your immigration policy. But and it was as if, just to get back to the main point, it was as if all of this was them just throwing in the towel and saying they didn't want to know. But of course, nevertheless, I wanted them to lose. I was all in on the zero seats meme. And then it's a, I don't want to jump ahead, but then it was like Reform UK Farage got up and running, and that's where it was. But they've just been hemorrhaging support ever since. So it was all the first sort of week or two of the campaign was really strange. It was really just a litany of gaffes and sort of making the Tory party even more of a lolcow than it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been looking at the polls, and of course, the general polls don't tell how it's going to play out in particular districts, but the most recent poll has Labour at 42%, the Conservatives at 19%, Reform UK, which basically has come from nowhere, is at 18%, the Lib Dems are at 11%, the Greens at 5%, Scottish National Party at 3%. Of course, that doesn't tell you how many seats they're going to get. It's not like Conservative is going to get 19% of the seats, because that depends on how many districts they actually get a majority in. It is conceivable that they could get zero seats. Although I understand there are a few safe conservative districts. And if it were just basically conservative versus labor with the others, the Liberal Democrats and the Greens thrown in, that it's conceivable that because of a few very, very Tory boroughs or districts or whatever you call them, they could have some safe seats. But then Nigel Farage has come into the equation. And Nigel Farage, of course, is further eroding the number of people who will actually vote for the Tories, because he's a known figure, but he's running a somewhat fresh campaign. He's saying a lot of things that people want to hear about migration. And I'm very, very hopeful, especially for England. I don't know how he plays in Scotland or Wales or Northern Ireland, but the bulk of the seats are in England. I don't think there are there any Tory seats in Scotland to fight over at this point? So yeah, let's talk a bit about Farage. Do you think Farage entering this might bring us closer to the dream of zero seats?
I'll let Mark take that one.
Yeah, Mark, do you want to go first?
Well, I'll say this. The way, and you touched on this, the way the first past the post system is set up in Britain is very, very undemocratic. It basically forms a system where if you don't vote for the winning candidate, your vote essentially doesn't count. And that sounds like an odd thing to say, that your vote doesn't count, but it doesn't. And that leads people to voting for two parties. So if you don't like Labour, you vote Tory. If you don't like Tory, you vote Labour. So it moves to a system of tactical voting. And this is what all of the parties play up. Now, I was saying to Greg and Morgoth before this, I've actively been involved in electoral politics, or was for 10 years. So I know about this. I've seen leaflets where parties will say, we're the only party in this area that can beat Labour. So if you're not voting for us, you're wasting your vote. So they all play up to this, which is a really scummy thing to do, to be fair. And you can see how unfair it is. By the last time when UKIP really went for a general election, UKIP got nearly 4 million votes, but won one seat. So they took 12% of the vote, but only one seat. So that bodes very, very badly for Nigel Farage and Reform. And it might initially make you think, well, hey, it won't be zero seats because Reform aren't going to be getting anybody in. And it's highly unlikely Reform get many people in at all. I mean, if Farage gets in, that would be a miracle in itself. So why is Farage standing so important? Well, there is a quirk to this system. And the quirk to this system is that if a small party takes aim at one of the two major parties and almost commits to, say, a kamikaze style attack on that major party, they can take just enough of that major party's vote in marginal constituencies up and down the country to almost completely wipe that party out. And that's what Nigel Farage is doing. He's going in hard on the things that Conservative voters care about, but have been repeatedly let down on. So he's going in hard on illegal immigration. He wants net zero, which to most people sounds great. You know, well, we won't have a positive net migration anymore. It'll be one in, one out. You know, we won't be seeing these houses popping up all over the countryside. You know, we won't be seeing this endless congestion. This will ease hospital waiting lists. He's now saying deport all illegal migrants. Well, that's 2 million people. Imagine how much better the country would be if 2 million people, just sort of like Thanos from Avengers, just clicked your fingers and 2 million illegals disappeared. The country would be markedly better off. And the Conservatives have let the public down on all these things again and again. And you've got to remember, Cameron came in with net migration to in the tens of thousands. Theresa May, net migration in the tens of thousands. Boris Johnson,
a tough Australian-style points-based immigration system, and they've let everyone down. Farage is also going out against the European Court of Human Rights, saying it's this human rights legislation that stops us having any sovereignty in Britain. We've got to finish the Brexit battle. We've got to get ourselves out of the European Court of Human Rights. He's going in hard on what the Daily Mail reader, sort of true blue Tories, actually want. And I think he's going to be very successful. I think he could take nationally around 15 to 20% of the vote. And that's huge. That's huge. And if he does that, will he get many seats? No, he won't. But what will that do? That will lead to the dream that we're all discussing, which is zero seats. And I'm not going to divulge any more because I'm sure we're going to get onto this. But zero seats is so damn important. Because the Conservative Party, as Greg so rightfully said early on, has to be punished. It has to be destroyed. Because these fake Conservative parties are one of the greatest blockades to nationalist success all over the Western world.
Absolutely. Morgoth, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean,
Farage wild card.
Yeah, I mean, my worry is that somewhere down the line, and Mark knows a lot more about electoral politics than me, but my worry is that somewhere down the line, this will be folded back into the Tory party. Or, I mean, he has really been going for the Tories, so I think he's made genuine enemies in the upper sort of ranks of the party, so it may not be feasible. But when we look back, Farage does have a history of creating up a big sort of positive energy on the right, and then just walking away and watching it implode. This is why I'm kind of, yeah, I like it. I like what I'm seeing. I like the vibe, but I'm still at the same time reluctant to get too carried away because I feel like I've seen this show before a few times. Mm-hmm. But that said, I mean, one of the things that's going on in the media at the moment, and we touched on it off stream about they seem to have been set up where they had these. They've had like Channel 4 journalists embedded there, and they caught them out saying all kinds of things. And one of them, it turns out, alleged is an actor. And the establishment are really going for them. And I think what originally the general attitude of the Tories was like, yeah, we are going to get a kicking. But it's going to be brutal, but you know, we'll be okay. Finance will keep the party on life support until we come back in a few years. And I think what's happened is that they realize that something's not quite right, that it isn't just this kind of ritualistic punishment, but people are actually out to destroy the party, even though, and this is where I think the zero seats meme is great, is because it runs against the logic of the system. We've been trapped within this sort of Chinese finger trap for decades. But at this point, everybody on the right should be getting cold feet. They've had a bit of a grumble about the Tories, but then they're going to go in and vote for them anyway just because they're scared of Labour. But I think the crimes of the Tory party have been so severe that the people aren't really that scared of the Labour Party anymore. I mean, I'm not optimistic about what Labour will do, but I do think it's good. I do think we're going to have to take the pain and think long term and then just break the kneecaps of the Tory party once and for all, because we're going to be stuck in this trap. There's people counter-signaling for me on Twitter, for example, and they'll be like, yeah, well, you're going to get let the Labour in. You don't know how bad Labour is going to be and all of this. And it's like, well, yeah, well, they're going to win anyway, but we can either win with the Tory party still breathing to come back, you know, five years' time or whatever, or we can do as much damage to them now so that it's almost impossible for them to get back up. But it's kind of revolutionary to work against the logic of the system in this way. Mm-hmm. And I think it's good. And I think the Tories, especially once Farage has got underway and started to go for them. I mean, in things like The Telegraph and The Times, you've got people like Daniel, like tall, real sort of Tory luminaries like Daniel Hannan, are coming out now and saying, like, people are going to regret destroying the Tory party, as if it's a as if it's a done deal, as if like it's already assured. But they're terrified. They're really starting to think, okay, we signed up for a bit of a beating. We didn't sign up to get beaten to death. That this is taking too far. And I like that. I like the fear that's setting in.
Mm-hmm. It strikes me that it may not be possible for Farage to do some deal down the road with the Tories and merge his party in with them. And I wanted to ask you both about this. Just how vulnerable would the Tory party be if it went from the ruling party to, say, I don't know, the fourth largest party in the country with 0 seats or 5 seats or something like that? Just how vulnerable would it be? Does it have an endowment like Harvard University? Does it have billions of dollars that it's just sitting on collecting interest so it can keep its vast staff and all these consultants and all these politicians just on payroll while their party has no power to influence policy whatsoever? Or, like most political parties, are they basically cash-strapped and dependent on large donations from the usual kinds of people who donate to these parties to produce measurable policy results? And if they go to a minuscule party, if they have fewer seats than the Greens or something, are those donors simply going to abandon them? Well, of course they'll abandon them because they can't produce any results. If they are abandoned by donors, can they keep their staff? Can they keep their politicians? Can they keep their strategists? Or are these people going to have to be laid off? Or are they going to bolt to other parties or go to the private sector, quangos, whatsoever? Would there be a vast exodus of rats from the Tory ship? So in effect, it could not ever be put back together again. That's what my hope is. And maybe you gentlemen know enough about how the party is financed to say whether that's likely or not. Or do they just have billions of dollars to wait out an election cycle and hope that they'll recover?
That's a very difficult question to answer, actually. And it stumps me a little bit. But I will say this, in this country, you know, we are the sort of archetypical sort of parliamentary democracy, if you like. And there are different tiers of power, though. And you do have people in at local level. And local level is, you know, local councillors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But those people really don't have much say. There would still be Conservative Party councillors. But if there was no national Conservative Party, I can't see how the Conservative Party would continue. I think then there would be a genuine further realignment where you started to see people like Boris Johnson. I think people like Boris Johnson may well come together with Nigel Farage and others and form something new. And more liberal Conservatives would go their own way. And they would then form a party that intended to become the next sort of official opposition, if you like. And that new opposition would be made up of some former Tories, some people who were obviously in Reform, and other people who might have been in other parties, say UKIP, might have taken place part in the Brexit movement, etc. And I think it would cause a genuine realignment. And I think at that point, different Conservative Party councillors would then decide where they fell, you know, in that shuffle. But at the moment, Conservative Party doesn't have that many councillors because they've been getting thrashed at local level because of their unpopularity at national level because of the failures of the government. So I can definitely see something big happening here if it goes down low enough. Because you've got to remember, if it does go down to virtually nothing, and if Sunak himself and others lose their seats, that would be completely humiliating. And at that point, you will find the
you will find there are two new oppositions, effectively. There will be a left-wing opposition, which will be largely an anti-Zionist left that will probably come out of the Labour Party. And then you will find an anti-immigration right, and that will likely be led by Farage. So I think this could cause a similar situation to what we saw in Canada in 1993.
I just did a Google search because I was aware that they are actually losing donors. Because I put something out the other day on Sir John Hall, who used to own Newcastle United Football Club, and he was one of the biggest Tory donors, and he switched to Reform. So I just put it into Google here, Tory donors, and pressed on the search thing, and what's come up is, one day ago, in the Financial Times, no less, donors desert Tory party as election campaign struggles. Sky News, Tory donors go on strike. Perhaps Sunak should dip into his own pockets. Politics Home, inside the battle for political donors. Bloomberg.com, Conservative donors flirt with Farage as fight for UK election money heats up. And then there's the who are the biggest funders and who funds. So the Tory party sitting on further £5 million from disgraced donor. So they even go, this is an earlier one from March. But the reason why I was aware of that was because something has been happening, which I found fascinating, where, so when I was talking about all the gaffes they had, I think it was like 10 days or 2 weeks in, the Tory party announced that they didn't actually have any money left for the campaign. Or they were down to like 200 grand or something. I didn't actually know why, but it looks like, I think maybe the donors had pulled out even before Farage. I think everybody, some of the donors are even throwing money into the Labour Party now.
And you Amazing. Just have a
general sense that everybody just despises the Tories. And what they put out on social media was that a lot of the sort of, In the American term, would be like a battleground sort of state. You've got these regions where it could go either way, and then the mm-hmm. Tories have got their safe seats as well in the shires and whatnot. Rishi Sunak is we're in the situation where Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, could lose his seat, which has never happened before. And what they're terrified of is that because none of the seats are safe, which is just crazy, it means that their big names, their big stars, could lose their seats. Mm-hmm. And so if you imagine, so first of all, what they did was put out an announcement that some of the seats, say where I come from, which is in the Northeast, which Boris with traditionally Labour, now they'll all be going for Reform. This is another thing, because I think the assumption was they would either stay home or go back to Labour. But then with Reform going on, because they're socially conservative, working class whites, now they're going for Reform, which also eats into Labour's vote a little bit as well. But in these areas where the Tories could be battling on the ground over all of these votes, a kind of announcement came out about 5 days ago that actually just give it up. We don't have the resources to fight on all of these fronts. And so what they instructed their frontline sort of, councillors and staff and all of this was to pull themselves back because they need to reroute everything to protect their big beasts, as they call them. People like Penny Mordaunt, Rishi Sunak, all of these big name Tories. So
it's these horrible people. We have to save the horrible clique that has brought this party to its absolute lowest point in its history. Yeah, Penny Mordaunt. We have to rally to save Rishi Sunak. It's so comical.
It's like this is the final battle, and they're all the most woke and the most kind of globalist shills, and so all of the actual sort of Tories are just going to be thrown under the bus. They've got to pull back. you got to pull back your front lines to protect the to protect the motherland of Rishi Sunak's constituency and Penny Morton and all these globalist scumbags that have betrayed the nation for 14 years. This is the hill that you have to die on. This is where you've got to bring back the troops. This is like the hot gates. We can't allow them to pass. It's Penny Morton's seat. They're such scum. Hopefully it'll all go. It'll all come crashing down on them.
Well, I did not.
Well, the significance of that, Morgoth, is more than you've said. Like, it is typical for most parliamentary elections for very, very little to be done in seats like Penny Mordaunt's seat, Rishi Sunak's seats, because they're safe seats. The major battles and the majority of the spending all happens in your marginals, which, as you said, they would be what we call your battleground states in the US, the ones that flip red, blue, and then back again. But the interesting thing is here, and this tells you what a state that party's in, the Conservative Party, obviously, what a state they're in, is that they're now saying, pull back. We haven't got what it takes to win any of these marginals anymore. We should see the marginals as lost. We must go and fight in our core heartlands, the places which, you know, would just get an A5 leaflet and forgotten about. We are now having to go hell for leather just to win in our heartlands, which tells you how bad this really is for the Conservatives and how close they actually are to completely collapsing.
I did not know that they were basically so hollowed out financially that they went into this election with no money in the bank. That's extraordinary. The mismanagement of this party is astonishing. But just watching it from across the pond, what I've been seeing is a parade of affirmative action candidates, basically historic firsts, the first, you know, well, another woman, right? Or a cabinet with no white males. Oh, happy day. Well, you know, this is the new Britain. And then Sunak. And then you get these people like, what, Kemi Bradenock are being trotted out. Maybe she'll be a good PM someday. Or this black guy. And the reasoning over there, I suspect, is basically the same reasoning we have in the United States, for instance, in the last midterm elections, where the Republican Party basically, they don't care about anything except globalism and moneyed donors that profit from globalization. That's whose pockets they're in, you know, and that's who they serve. And so they think, well, these leftists, they're so mean. They call us names. They call us racist and sexist. We'll show them. We'll find Caitlyn Jenner. And we'll have Caitlyn Jenner go out and be a talking head advocating oligarchy and globalism. And they can't accuse us of being transphobic. Well, they didn't actually do this, but Caitlyn Jenner's floating around on the margins of Republican politics. Someday, say, you know, he, she, whatever's thrown her hat or whatever in the ring a couple of times talking about this. So it's going to happen someday. Or Dr. Oz, the Turk, or this babbling black football player from Georgia, I forget his name now. These people were put forward basically as just racism insurance, because nothing is more important than just having plausible sounding spokesman for globalism and oligarchy. And if they're brown or female or transgender or whatever, some historic first, and they repeat these empty globalist talking points, that's good enough. That's good enough for the Republican Party. And of course, it was roundly defeated. A lot of these historic firsts went down to defeat. And I saw this happening in Great Britain. I forget the name of the black guy that they were putting forward. Maybe he'll be a good PM. It's like, there's no way on earth that this guy would ever be chosen in a meritocracy. And yet these people are being put forward because you have fundamentally unserious people in charge who are petrified of having woke journalists point at them and call them racist. And so they take out these enormously expensive insurance policies and put these pinheads in positions of authority. And these pinheads have basically destroyed the Conservative Party now. And but the idea that you would call a general election when you don't even have money to run it. I mean, the level of incompetence here, the level of incompetence of having an outdoor thing where you announce this thing and you haven't checked to see what likelihood there's going to be of a downpour. I mean, the levels of incompetence and stupidity here are astonishing. And we like to think that our enemies are clever. They're certainly doing diabolically evil things. And so we think maybe there's a diabolical cleverness behind it. But I just see stupidity. I see interlocking stupidity, sort of self-reinforcing cycle, downward spirals of stupidity leading to the destruction of this traitorous and evil institution.
I mean, I do think, I didn't mean to cut off, Barker's got anything to say there, but one thing I was going to say is that what hasn't been discussed, strangely not discussed very much, is something quite obvious, which the Tory party themselves can't address. And it's that people don't want to have an Indian prime minister. You see all of these, you've kind of got all of these takes, you've got all these things, you've got all these strategies going around. And what's happened is that I think they've kind of convinced themselves of their own lies and bullshit because they've been out of touch with the general population for so long. Because, you know, the treachery isn't particularly new to the Tory party. But, like, what they have done is tell themselves that we are all these neoliberal global citizens and that they don't represent anything and, you know, all of this. We're just an economic zone. But when the sort of revealed preferences, if you like, where people who would never in a million years own up to having any kind of racial bias or, you know, resentment to somebody because of their colour, they'll fill in all of the polls as if to say, well, you know, I judge the person on their character and all of this. But when it comes down to it, I actually think that one of the reasons why this is so catastrophic is because they just don't want to have a brown man, an Indian man, as their leader, as their figurehead. They just don't want it. And they would never say that in public. But this is definitely an element. And the Tories themselves can't actually play that card. They can't actually say, well, one of the reasons why voters are deserting the Tory party is because they're racist. So they've got them. And again, it's like it's the incompetence of just viewing everything through spreadsheets and data. Because remember, Rishi Sunak was completely parachuted in. He was prepped for this position without any consultation with the British public, with their base, with people, regardless of what they might think of it. He was imposed on us by the elite. And you can see, in my opinion, that one of the elements which plays into this is that people just don't want to be ruled by somebody as foreign as Rishi Sunak.
Well, I think that's a very important thing.
Well, let's go a step further here, though, Morgoth. Rishi Sunak was actually defeated by Liz Truss. The Conservative Party overwhelmingly voted for Liz Truss to be the next Prime Minister. And then the upper echelons of the Conservative Party, who weren't happy with that decision, did everything they could to undermine the will of their own party in order to ensure that they would never, ever, ever get to have what they wanted. And what they wanted was a white party. But again, I've been doing this for a long time and I've been to these election counts. I've met Conservative Party people. And when you're at an election count as a BNP candidate or counting agent, you would never, ever speak to the Lib Dems or the Labour Party people. They would hate you. If you looked at them, it would be like they turned into a monster from a horror movie and just hissed back at you. They just despised you. But you would speak to most people from UKIP. The vast majority of people from UKIP would give you the sly thumbs up. And a lot of Conservatives did as well. I remember speaking to Conservatives at election counts, and they were like, look, we agree with you on almost everything, you know, but we're true blue, we'll stick with the Conservatives forever. And the Conservative Party general membership is actually what the Conservatives would regard as pretty racist.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they don't want this. They find this nauseating, and that's why they didn't vote Sunak. That's why they voted Liz Truss. They'd vote anyone to stop someone like Sunak taking over the party. And now this is being reflected in the votes. But get this, and this is, you can look this up. The Conservative Party used to deliver leaflets in certain parts of the country, and I'm not going to say what it said in full, but the headline on these leaflets used to read, if you want an N-word for a neighbour, vote Labour. That used to be a Tory party election slogan. They knew their voters didn't want this. They knew their members didn't want this. And this desire from the upper echelons of the party to push it upon the party at any cost, basically, you know, you're having this whether you like it or not, you know, like a child with, you know, with a bottle of cod liver oil, you know, except for cod liver oil is actually good for you, whereas this is bad for you, you know, it's like you're taking it, you're taking the medicine whether you like it or not. And that's exactly what this is, and that is why the Conservative Party are now in this mess, because their core support base has far more in common with, if you like, the sort of the Geordies that Morgoth would have been around. They, you know, people who basically don't want immigration, they don't want to see their country being taken over. And to actually see the party they've supported for years being led by somebody who is clearly, to normal people, a foreigner. And the fact they're trying to make it taboo to say that he's an Indian or a foreigner just annoys people even more.
Yeah.
This is rubbing them up the wrong way. And they don't understand. Yeah. You know, they don't understand that. Or they do understand and they refuse to admit it, but the upper echelons of the party are completely out of touch with their grassroots activists and their voters. And Sunak is the cherry on top of this out of touch cake that you've been discussing with all these diversity hires. And he's the ultimate diversity hire.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, interestingly enough, there's something especially offensive about the subcontinental male. And I've been noticing this. I especially noticed this at the G7 thing. I was watching clips from Sunak there. Just the sheer buffoonery and lack of gravitas. And I've seen this with a lot of Indian men. They don't want to be taken seriously. They act like clowns or buffoons. I don't know what it is, if it's some kinds of insecurity that they are trying to head off. They think you're going to laugh at them, so they behave like a buffoon and take control of the factor or the disaster or whatever. But I've seen this, I've seen this in the United States with various Indian Americans or just Indians who were in the United States that I've met over the years. It's not entirely the case, but it is a very widespread kind of behavior. And to see the Prime Minister of Great Britain, you know, an heir to one of the great civilizations of world history, just behaving like this goofy buffoon. He doesn't even have the dignity of the money that he comes from, much less the dignity of the office. It's just embarrassing. And to me, I think maybe the embarrassment that Britons might feel seeing this goofball clowning around with Giorgia Meloni and others is equivalent to the deep kind of metaphysical embarrassment, the cringe that I feel at having Joe Biden as my president. And it's just a humiliation that was inflicted upon the people. And I think Biden is a kind of almost symbolic humiliation of the Trump voters. You know, if they're going to steal the election, couldn't they at least put somebody plausible in Trump's place? No, they put the least plausible candidate in his place, the greatest possible contrast in his place. Again, you just think, is this being scripted by Hollywood or by hell or something? You know, you think there's some kind of demonic intelligence or sense of humor here. They're out to humiliate us all.
No, but the thing is, Greg, whereas in America, you do get the beauty of seeing Trump destroy him in a presidential debate and everyone laughs and points. Here in Britain, and I think Morgoth will agree here, Sunak and Starmer and the other weak leaders, they don't really face the kind of public humiliation that Biden has been sort of subjected to. I don't know what you think about that, Morgoth. It almost seems as if Starmer and Sunak are so protected here by the press, the media, by the political establishment. They never get that deep humiliation that Biden experienced just the other night.
Yeah, I mean, I remember watching the Sunak and Liz Truss debates that they had. I couldn't bear to even watch the Sunak-Starmer ones. But what they want to do is keep everything to economics because it's safe. Economics and the NHS. And there was it's worth just repeating as well that this is the precarious position that the Tories found themselves in before Nigel Farage sort of came in with the killing blow, which is what's happened right at the most vulnerable moment, because again, that Chinese finger trap that's now already sort of maxed out, and then now they've got an alternative party to vote for. So it's just absolute calamity. But what I think as well is that we're thinking back on the Liz Truss. I think if Liz Truss was still the leader, the Tories would still be getting slaughtered. But I do think that she'd be able to hoover up and maintain a certain amount of votes in the Tories because she speaks to a kind of batty aunt, a gardener's world, English heritage kind of vibe that a lot of people would go for. The kind of dopey, well-meaning, middle-aged woman, who likes to garden and she likes to play bowls or whatever. That's kind of what she gave off. And so when they stabbed her in the back, as they do everybody else, and put Rishi Sunak in the place, they didn't have anything to replace that with. There was no longer any kind of cultural identity or affinity or anything like that.
Mark, you have a tale to tell, an infiltrator and subverter to the BNP that I thought sounded remarkably like the charges that Farage has made, that Labour or the Conservatives, for that matter, they're capable of anything too, have put some kind of infiltrator in to reform, to say all kinds of very un-PC things. And then, of course, the press points and gasps about that. Do you want to tell that story? Because I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead.
I'm pleased you brought that up, because when Farage came out and said, look, this guy's been planted in our midst. This is a dirty smear tactic. This guy's a paid actor. He's clearly got links with media companies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the same media companies he's got links with were there on hand to secretly film him, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of people are like, oh my God, Farage is coming out with the conspiracy theories, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I've got to tell everyone here tonight, exactly the same thing happened when I was in the BNP. So in the early 2000s, the BNP were doing very well in two northern mill towns, Oldham and Burnley. And the BNP broke through in Burnley. It never broke through in Oldham. In fact, despite Nick Griffin getting 16.4% in Oldham and doing very well there in a parliamentary election, which was at the time was unprecedented for a nationalist candidate to get that kind of vote. I think that's the highest a nationalist candidate's ever got. It's never been broken since then. We were expected to win seats in Oldham. And the local organiser, Mick Treacy, was a real hard-working guy. He was always out leafleting. We were standing a load of candidates. Everyone was really doing their best. And we were sure we were going to get somebody elected in Oldham because the grooming scandal was going on there. There'd been riots. There'd been white boys regularly attacked. There'd been a brutal anti-white murder in the town. Everything was going our way. And this guy called Barry Bennett turned up and he was real eager. one of those guys that if you sent out a text message, who's coming leafleting, Barry would be there. He'd be there and he would work super hard and he'd be the first one there, the last one to leave. He'd come down the pub with you and he'd be there the next night. And everyone liked Barry because Barry was doing a lot of good work for the BNP. As I said, he was what we called like a super activist. And super activists are people that are out every night pounding the street, really doing the work. And about a week before the election, the local Oldham newspaper ran this big front page headline, BNP rapist, with a big picture of Barry Bennett out with the BNP lads delivering leaflets. And that was a body blow for the party in Oldham. It really was a body blow for the party. It left the party in absolute disarray. And the party still polled very well, but never, ever got a candidate elected in Oldham in its entire, you know, it's a whole electoral height over that decade of the 2000 to 2010, never got anyone elected in Oldham. And it was largely put down to this Barry Bennett fiasco. And then eventually the branch organiser, Mick Treacy, he was like, I've had enough. You know, I've lost everything doing what I'm doing, packed it in. And Oldham sort of spiraled from there. And it never regained its sort of heyday, like when Nick Griffin got 16.4% and he was buzzing for the BNP. But it turned out that Barry Bennett, the BNP rapist in inverted commas, was actually the brother-in-law of a leading Labour councillor in the area. And Labour, knowing of this man's, you know, past, you know, he did it a long time ago. Not that that makes it any better, but it was something that, you know, most people wouldn't even know about him until the press revealed this, because he did it when he was a youth. But Labour knew, and Labour put that guy in with the BNP so that he would be out everywhere. He'd be always seen with us. And then all these photographs of him working with us would emerge, and boom, we were absolutely sunk in Oldham. And we never, never recovered after that. But it wasn't something that happened by accident. It was something that was done by malice. That guy was put in our ranks by the Labour Party, and it absolutely destroyed the party in the area. And I can absolutely believe now that Nigel Farage has done a lot of damage to the Conservative Party. The establishment are very worried because they do not want this two-party system to collapse. The establishment won Tory, Labour. You vote Labour to get the Tories out, you vote Tory to get Labour out. That's what they want. Absolutely. They do not want that breaking, because if the Tories are destroyed, it's likely that Labour would then face major internal schisms, because that's generally what happens when one party has all the power. They end up then fighting over amongst themselves over that power. And they don't want this, because basically Britain has been one of the bedrocks of Western liberal democracy and one of the forerunners of this crooked two-party system. And if Britain was to go down a new route and there was a big realignment, all the old political alliances were broken, people started voting outside of that, you know, two-party Labour-Tory dichotomy, that would be something that would really worry the establishment.
Absolutely. I think that this is a great opportunity, because the establishment might not be able to keep the Tories alive at this point. And there probably will be another center-right thing, just because if there's a vacuum, something will take the place. It probably will be reform. And you'll go back to something resembling the two-party system, but I think significantly realigned against globalism and in a more populist and sovereigntist nationalist sort of direction, which I think would be good for Great Britain and good for the rest of the world. I would like to see a realignment of politics, not around left and right, but around globalist versus nationalist. I think that's really the great issue of our time. And it would be nice to see that happen in the UK first. Well, it's happened. It's already happened, really, in some ways in France. But, you know, the UK as well, it would be great.
Yeah, I mean, as an amateur gardener, one of the things that I've learned is that nature hates open soil, and it looks to plant things in it as fast as possible. And what we're trying to do here is clear away the dead wood of the Tory party and plant something new on the British right. And there'll be a race to fill that vacuum and to use that space. And at the moment, as you say, it looks like it's a reform. But even within reform, reform's kind of schizophrenic, because you've got Richard Tice, who's much more of a kind of Tory kind of man, in my view. He's very boring and safe and banal. And so you get one set of messaging coming out from what seems to be his camp. But then you'll get something completely opposite from Farage. And Farage is much more close to young Zoomers who are very savvy with making memes and getting snappy videos out where Farage looks funny. And this Farage's social media campaign has been fantastic. There's lots of the funny sort of tour of Toad Hall stuff, which you usually expect from Farage. But even there was one where it was just him walking through a field in Kent. So he totally ditched that sort of, man of the city look. And instead he was there in his barber jacket with his dog. And he walked through the golden corn, and then he sat there and he just kind of honestly said, like, the country's falling apart. We can't go on like this. I was set to retire, but I thought something had to be done. And I thought, it hit just the right note where he's not trying to present himself as all public relations coded and slick and everything.
He's like Cincinnatus, who's being dragged from his farm in a time of national peril to do his duty. Seems very unpolitical in a very good way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hesitant to be too kind to Farage. But I do feel there's an element of that, because what happened was before the election, I think it was just after the election was announced, Farage was actually set to quit Britain and go over to America, basically to help with the Trump campaign. And I thought, what a shitbag. In this particular moment, you're now heading off. Yeah, I'm sure it looks great. The idea of playing golf in Florida with Donald Trump when we're dealing with this. And I was proven completely wrong, because within 2 weeks, he was like, I'm heading straight back into it. And there's this announcement. And immediately the energy just changed completely. I mean, as I speak now, there's just a multitude of scandals going on. For example, he was on the flagship BBC political debate program called Question Time. And it was obvious that the audience was just completely stacked with libtards against Farage. And what we've got is this quango in the UK called Ofcom, which are supposedly a neutral observer. It's this Blairite quango. Everybody knows this is rubbish. Everybody knows what they do is clamp down hard on right of centre views and protect left of centre views. That's just the way it works. And so as I understand it, this is just ongoing, like happening right now, is that Farage is saying he's gonna report the Question Time to Ofcom. And so what you see is this kind of cascading effect where a lot of people sitting at home are going to be thinking, what is Ofcom? What does Ofcom actually do? And all of these insidious secretive NGOs and quangos get dragged out into the sunlight when things like this happen, which even that is good. And it adds to the kind of disillusionment about how politics works. So in Britain, whatever goes on television, whatever you're consuming, and soon on the internet, is filtered through Ofcom for political correctness. And another hope not hate thing as well, where they've now been called out, because it's obvious they're getting called out, but not just by Farage, also by Galloway for election interference. And it's good to see this, because when I
and they've been banned on Twitter for a week for doxing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some people have been trying to highlight that, you know, maybe they should help Elon Musk's moderators and just in case they're repeat offenders. You never know.
I love that. I'm glad you jumped on that. Just for our American audience, I think we need to define Quango, because unless you are a yes minister lover or you follow the British press, you don't know. Quango is an acronym for quasi-autonomous national government organization. And what these are is they're supposedly devolved power groups, and they're supposedly part of civil society, and they're supposedly autonomous to some extent from the government, and maybe even above politics. And of course, they're just staffed cellar to rafters with left liberal activists pursuing their agenda, grinding their axes, stacking the deck for their policies. So Quango just means these, it's like an NGO. It's a British NGO, but it's not non-governmental. It's governmental, but quasi-autonomous, whatever that means. It's just in a gray zone, basically, but it's certainly not autonomous of the center left. I guess I would put it that way. It's like a university, you know. Technically, it's neutral, but they're just rotten with center left activists.
Yeah, and all of these are the legacy of Tony Blair.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, of course, just to get back to the Tories for a second, is that they came in knowing that all of these things, the Equality Act was another one, all of the, like, this institutionalized left liberal globalist Blairite kind of ideology that was in there. The Tories could have tore it all out. They could have been the lot, especially with the majority they had in after 2019. But even when Cameron came in as the heir to Blair. So the betrayal, it isn't just in immigration numbers, but even in like the way that power and institutions was all of this Blairite left-wing stuff was in there. And the Tories didn't just burn it all down. They actually added onto it. So something like Ofcom, they got the green light to move from. Originally, that was to monitor, let's say the telephone lines were working. And then the creep just kept growing and growing and growing till eventually it replaced what was a traditional sort of censorship apparatus that we had for television with this Quango, which was left wing. Of course, not explicitly, but it is there. And then they've expanded that with the Online Harms Bill to include the internet. So it'll just be everything will have to go through this filter. Again, I could go on all day, but the Tories could have ended this. They could have ripped it out, and they didn't. They added to it. And this is like the immigration numbers are bad enough, and the woke stuff is bad enough. But just either they are incompetent or they wanted all of this stuff left in place. All of the nudge units, the applied psychology stuff, all of that was amped up after 2010 when the Tories got in. And what's great is that when you actually see the Farage thing, I'll say again, like, okay, whatever you think of them, but you begin to see the kind of the scaffolding of power exposed, and that's what I really like. And in the Reform Manifesto, which was a kind of buffet of all different populist talking points, you saw quite a bit of that. They just want to scrap the Equality Act, which for the Americans would be the equivalent of just saying we're going to throw out the Civil Rights Act. Mm-hmm. Which, so that's where the meat is for me in all of this, because it begins to speak to how government actually works, how all of this is, how all of this kind of poison is embedded within institutions of power. And when people start actually get into that, that's the good stuff.
Wonderful. Mark, we've kept you more than an hour. It's been a while since you've been on. It's great to have you back. I have been following you, of course, on Telegram and following Patriotic Alternative, following what happened with Laura Towler and Sam Melia, with absolute solidarity, of course, just, you know, watching all that happening. You're doing so much, and I really, really appreciate it. Can you tell our folks how they can follow your work and maybe contribute to it?
Oh, well, that would be wonderful if people wanted to do that. I'm obviously on Odyssey. I'm now also on Rumble. I hope Countercurrents is on Rumble at some point because there's growing audiences there. I'm also on DLive, and for my social media, I'm on Telegram and Gab. I still do my weekly videos. I still do Patriotic Weekly Review every Wednesday. I still have a pack schedule. It's just not seen by as many people, sadly, because unfortunately, I've had my wings clipped in terms of being able to be on social media, but I really appreciate being here tonight and being in such good company. So thank you so much for inviting me, Greg. It's a pleasure working with you as always. You know,
everybody who's on X, Twitter right now, you need to add Mark Collett, and you need to add...
I'm not on X. They let me back and they kicked me off, unfortunately.
But we need to add Mark to the list of people that we constantly copy Elon Musk on and say, why is Jared Taylor and Mark Collett banned from this platform? Why is Jared Taylor and Laura Towler banned from this platform? Because that kind of nagging activism actually works. Another thing is this: if you've been taken off of X or Twitter, just appeal. Because oftentimes, if you just ask, it'll hit the right desk at the right moment and you'll get your account back. I've been trying to do this with two banned accounts that I had. One was my old personal account. The other was the old Countercurrents account. And I keep doing that. Every month I will log in, I will appeal, and I will say, I was just exercising my First Amendment rights as an American citizen. I did that once with my old personal account, went out for a walk in the afternoon, came home and had a letter saying that they had reinstated it and they had made a mistake and they were very sorry. And I'm going to try and get the old Countercurrents account back too. So you might just do that. You might just be a squeaky wheel and try and do that. And folks who are on X, we need to get Mark back and Laura back and Jared Taylor, of course, because it's entirely arbitrary that some people are on that platform and others off. And if it's arbitrary, it's unjust, and we need to undo that somehow. So Mark, yeah, it's been great. Thank you so much. And let's definitely
thank you for such kind words. I look forward to working with you again in the future, doing more book reviews, and you'll have to come back on Patriotic Weekly Review at some point. I'm really looking forward to the American election, and I'll be putting together a panel for that. And I hope.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate the analysis you've given us.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
Well, have a lovely evening, everyone. Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.